We go underground once a month with our Underground History segment. It's about the always interesting work of archaeologists, guided by our resident archaeologists from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA. Chelsea Rose and Mark Tveskov are back, she in studio and he on the phone, to talk about one of their own projects, an examination of the Harris Cabin site in Josephine County, a few miles north of Grants Pass on the Merlin exit off the I-5 freeway. An incident of violence took place there in the 1850s when white settlers and natives engaged in a number of major battles, often collected under the name the Rogue Indian Wars. By the time the period was over, the white settlers were firmly entrenched and the remaining Native Americans were marched off to a reservation far from the Rogue Valley. Here are Chelsea Rose and Mark Tveskov. Thanks for joining us once again on the Jefferson Exchange.
Great to be here.
Mark, good to
talk
to you.
Great to be here.
So this is really, Chelsea, a stone's throw from I-5, I noticed, with North Valley High School in sight. Who were the Harrises?
The Harris family was recent immigrants to the Rogue River Valley. They came from, Illinois, I think. They came over the Oregon Trail, settled in the Willamette Valley in 1852, I believe, and came down to southern Oregon in 1854. So they hadn't been at their homestead for that long, and they were establishing a donation land claim right alongside the Applegate Trail. They were, you know, right in the line of the Rogue River War came right through their neighborhoods.
So they're kind of in a high-traffic neighborhood, mm-hmm. in a sense, yeah. So I understand, Mark Tveskov, they were related to the Hanley family of Hanley Road, Hanley Farm, all that?
Yeah, I don't know the exact linkage, but the daughter, Sophia, eventually married into the Hanleys, and they became, you know, pretty much a Rogue Valley royalty. They were part of the establishment of Jacksonville up into the 20th century.
The daughter, Sophia's, her daughter, so it's Mary is the mother, daughter, Sophia. Sophia's daughter, Mary, actually married into the Hanley family, and Claire Hanley is the daughter of that. So Sophia is the grandmother of one of the Hanley sisters who established the Historical Society, of course, Hanley Farm, and really was instrumental in the preservation and recording of history in Southern Oregon.
Wow, and history very strong in their family, obviously. Mm-hmm. They've been sort of in some pivotal moments there. How long had the Harrises lived at the cabin site by the time of this attack in the 1855, it looks like?
Less than a year, right, Mark?
Yeah, less than a year. They settled sometime in 1854, and they had basically just got their operation going.
And how big a farm was it, and what were they making there?
Well, that's a good question. There was at least the house, which was described as a two-story house with a loft, and then there was also a couple of outbuildings. They were probably ranchers growing wheat and potatoes and things like that.
And it was a 360-acre donation land claim, but only part of it was developed at this point.
Okay, so they weren't farming all 360 acres, which brings up a question about DLCs themselves, donation land claims. Chelsea, how did those work? I mean, did you have to file some paperwork or just claim a piece of property, or what happened?
Yeah, it was a process to encourage settlement in areas like this, and so you had to prove up on it. So you had to show that you were actually living on it and working the land in order to finalize all the paperwork after a set period of time. So people would build houses, they would clear fields. The paperwork also involved verification from neighbors to attest that, yes, you'd been here this many years and you'd done all this stuff. So there was some hoops to jump through, but at the end you got free or very cheap land. And in the case of the Harris family and others that were affected by the war, they never were able to finalize that, so it actually reverted back to the government. The DLC was canceled, basically, because they couldn't ever prove up on it.
Oh, because they weren't actually working the land. Once,
because,
yeah. Know, yeah, after the incident, which I don't think I even pointed this out yet, but it killed Mr. Harris, whose first name was?
George.
George. Okay.
George Harris.
George Harris got a bad rep with the local natives. Is that true, Mark?
Well, that's a rumor, and that's an unconfirmed rumor. There was a historian that wrote an article some years back, and I don't recall her name, but she implied that there was some bad blood between Mr. Harris and some of the Native American men over the abuse of Native American women. But we haven't been able to independently confirm that. We can say, however, that the morning of October 9th, 1855, when the Native Americans decided to fight back against the aggressions of the settlers, that they were selective in who they attacked. It wasn't an indiscriminate slaughter. They had definitely selected some people that they wanted to exact retribution against.
Right,
so it wasn't completely random.
Okay, so George Harris was selected. We just are not sure why.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
And another thing to keep in mind, too, is a lot of times families like this are portrayed as innocent victims. And part of the donation land claim process, whether, you know, implicitly or was that people knew, these settlers knew very well that they were settling on contested land. They were essentially squatters on Indian land. And so they justified it through manifest destiny and a lot of that. But so some of this retaliation, you know, they're not entirely innocent, of course.
Yeah. And it's, and one more thing about the donation land claims is in 1853, they signed the Table Rock Treaty, the United States government with the Takelma and Shasta of the Rogue Valley. And they did that after the gold rush had already started. So there were thousands of American settlers in Southern Oregon at that time. But by the law of the United States, they were, that those were illegal. They were squatting. By the law, the land at the time, the treaty was supposed to have been signed first, but the gold rush preempted that. So it was kind of a contradiction where the territory of Oregon said, go ahead and settle. But the federal government was like, well, we got to sign a treaty first. And that was a source of a lot of the conflict in that era.
So let's go further back then than the George Harris family. I mean, how close was any native habitation at that time or previous to that time?
Well, in 1854, 1855, many of the Native Americans in Southern Oregon were on the Table Rock Reservation, which was where Gold Hill and Rogue River are today, although they continued to follow their seasonal round of activities. So, for example, in that morning when the attack occurred, many of the Native Americans from the reservation were in the area, that general area, probably hunting and gathering, which is, was their usual and accustomed practice.
We're talking, this is our Underground History segment for the month with Chelsea Rose and Mark Tveskov of the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA. And we're talking about the Harris Cabin Massacre of October 1855, where there's been some recent some exploration at the site itself north of Grants Pass. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Chelsea, how big was the family? Who lived at the Harris Cabin?
There was George and Mary Harris were the parents. There was two children. Sophia was the daughter. She was like 11 or 12 at the time. And then I think John was the son, and he was about 9. And it's kind of a mystery whatever happened to the little boy. Some accounts say he was off at the garden picking potatoes, and the garden was like a quarter mile from the house. And other accounts say he was at a neighboring friend's house. But they never found him or his remains after this. And that was something that, according to documentary, you know, there's a lot of newspaper articles that say it kind of haunted the mother. The other thing, there was a gentleman living on the site, and Frank Reed, I think his name was, and some accounts say he was a hired hand, and other accounts say he was like kind of a partner in the farming business. And he was also killed, and his remains were found the following year.
So George Harris and Frank Reed killed. The son, nobody really knows what happened to him.
Presumably killed, but yeah.
And Mary Harris and her daughter Sophia survived.
And Sophia was shot in the arm and actually wounded.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's talk about the circumstances of the attack with some special attention to the events that preceded it. Mark, can you walk us through those?
Yeah, so in 1853, there was an attempt at peacemaking by the Takelma and Shasta and the territorial and federal government that created that Table Rock Reservation. But it never held because many of the settlers in Southern Oregon didn't acknowledge the authority of the treaty. It was like the run-up to the Civil War, so there was a lot of contested ideas about the federal government. And likewise, many of the Native Americans didn't agree with the treaty either. So warfare and tension and conflict never really stopped. And that kind of boiled over in the summer of 1855. Some Teamsters were murdered on the Siskiyou Summit, and the Table Rock, the Native Americans on the Table Rock Reservation were blamed. And then on October 8, 1855, a party of vigilantes from Jacksonville went down to the Rogue River in the vicinity of the Table Rock Reservation and attacked three Native American communities, murdering many people in them. And that was known as the Lupton Massacre. And at that point, the Native Americans on the reservation basically made one of two choices. They either trusted the promises of the government and went to the U.S. Army base at Fort Lane, or else decided to fight it out. And those that decided to fight it out were the ones that traveled up the Oregon-California Trail past what's today Merlin and Grants Pass, and basically attacked and murdered many settlers.
And that was not a short trip in those days, was it?
No, and they followed a path. They went from basically where Rogue River is today, followed the trail, what's today Interstate 5, and attacked 4, 5, 6 cabins along the way.
All right, so a direct result of this. Now, do we know anything about the individuals who were involved in both the Lupton Massacre or who responded to the Lupton Massacre with the Harris Cabin Massacre? Anything about them known?
James Lupton himself was a civil surveyor who lived in the White City area at the time. It wasn't called White City then. And he had just recently been elected to the territorial legislature to represent Southern Oregon. So that was one guy.
All right, but the rest of the band not known about it. And what about the Native Americans involved in any of these incidents?
Well, there was a Takelma leader named George and another named Limpy, and they seem to have been involved, and also a Shasta leader named Chief John, Tai John. And they were the main leaders of this party that decided to fight it out.
And so how did things unfold at the Harris Cabin?
Well, that's a matter of some debate, because a lot of the accounts come through this kind of heroic stories told 40 years later. But basically, Mr. Harris was shot outside, and he managed to get into the house with the women. Frank Reed was killed outside, and the boy, like we said, was never found. And basically, Mary Harris was barricaded in her house for a little while with her daughter and dead husband, and the family had a shotgun and were shooting through the chinks in the log cabin. The Native Americans around there were decided to wait them out. They apparently wanted to try to take her captive, so they basically set up a perimeter and tried to wait her out, and that lasted the entire night. And then the following morning, the soldiers from Fort Lane arrived and rescued her.
So it sounds like Mary Ann Harris and her daughter Sophia were actually fairly inventive in defending themselves.
Well, that's the story. I mean, the legend goes is that with his dying breath, Mr. Harris taught her how to mold bullets for the musket. But that's also a very heroic story that may be exaggerated.
All right. We're talking again in our Underground History segment with Mark Tveskov and Chelsea Rose of the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, talking about the Harris Cabin Massacre of October 9th, 1855. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Chelsea, I understand the site's been looked at several times by several crews. I did look at Brian O'Neill's work out of the University of Oregon. What is still remaining to be understood about what happened there, or is it a larger context you're looking to understand?
Well, we made a lot of progress in this last round, which we just did a month or so ago as part of our National Park Service Battlefield Grant to nominate all these sites to the Rogue River War to the National Register. So we wanted to go out there and kind of follow up on Brian O'Neill, Paul Baxter, and Chris Ruiz's work from the University of Oregon and see if the features that they found that they felt were associated with the Harris homestead, if we could kind of ground truth that. They also worked closely with the Hugo Neighborhood Association, which is a local history group that's really interested in this area. So we went out there and looked at the three features that they found, which were essentially rock piles, and this is all on state land. And one rock pile we discovered was just that, a rock pile. Like we said, the donation land claim involved. And also, if you're farming, you're clearing your land. This is really rocky up there. So it was just like a pile of rocks. You know, there was
just
no
to get them out of the way.
Yeah, just to get them out of the way and maybe use later. But there was no rhyme or reason to it. We thought maybe it'd be a well or something, but it wasn't. And then there's one pile that they thought was the cabin, and it really didn't have a lot of shape to it either. But there was one on the north which did. One of the first things we did was battle the very well-established poison oak in this area, which really proved our dedication as scientists, because even the most trained field techs who never get it got it on this trip. But
everybody's scratching, putting the calamine lotion on.
That's right. So we cleared it all, and we drew the rocks to scale. We had drone aerial photography with the drone, and we were able to get a look at these features from above and see what they might look like. So one of the features, which wasn't originally thought to be the cabin, you could really see a rectangular, basically a base of a foundation of a chimney. And so that doesn't happen when it's just a rock pile, you know, and there was different soil inside. Now, so we were able to do excavation and confirm that this was the location of a log cabin. Everything there is consistent with the 1850s. It's within the Harris homestead. So it seems to be pointing that that is the house, the cabin that was under fire. One of the main artifacts we found, which was pretty cool, was actually the chinking that would be between the logs to protect from drafts and bugs and
some
stuff.
Some kind of mortar or goop or some kind?
Yeah, it's like daub. So mm-hmm. it was just basically clay, earth, and you can actually see on it. If you don't know what you're looking for, it's kind of hard to see because it is just dirt. But you can see the grains of the wood and kind of the shape of where it was between the logs. It's really neat. And, of course, a lot of the documentary accounts talk about her, you know, knocking that out of the way so she could get the rifle through the logs to shoot out. So what we didn't find a lot of was domestic items and furnishings, you know, glass, ceramics, that kind of stuff you usually find on a homestead. So there's more work to be done there to see, but we feel pretty confident that we have the cabin. One of the other things that's kind of a mystery and really adds to telling of the story and getting through some of the rhetoric and the mythology of it is we found no musket balls, no ammunition of any kind, no percussion caps, none of the stuff that you usually find and you would find if this mother and daughter were actually under fire all night.
Ah, so the heroic stories then get called into question.
Yeah, and not to say that, not to doubt that she had a really bad night and that it was really traumatic to be in that cabin with your husband who is dead, but perhaps it was more of the threat that they were out there and not that she was actually under fire.
And are there contemporary accounts, Mark, other than Marianne Harris's account of what happened that night?
I think anyone who's ever said anything about the history of the Rogue Valley has had something to say about this story, either in the 1850s or more recently. So we have a firsthand account by numerous people. One of the Dragoon officers from Fort Lane described rescuing Mary Harris. Another officer from Fort Lane described visiting the cabin shortly after and seeing the bloodstains on the floor and reflecting on that. There's many different versions of the story, some more credible than others.
So is there direct connection between the events at Harris Cabin and the Battle of Hungry Hill, which you guys have been chasing for a long time?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're very much related. So the Harris Massacre was on October 9th. The Battle of Hungry Hill was on October 31st. So the Native Americans who perpetrated the attack on the Harrises were on their way into the hills about between Cow Creek and the Rogue River. And two and a half weeks later, whatever it was, that's where the Army found them and they fought the Battle of Hungry Hill. So the Army chasing the Native Americans was in direct response to these attacks that occurred on October 9th. And they were trying to put an end to the affair at the Battle of Hungry Hill.
Underground History, this segment, DeMark Tveskov and Chelsea Rose, the guests here on the Jefferson Exchange once again. So Chelsea, how much does new knowledge about the things that happen, and if there's a new diary or a discovery of another site, change what you do at the initial place? I mean, now that you know, for example, where the Battle of Hungry Hill took place, does that dictate a new approach at the Harris Cabin site?
You know, there's always a benefit to look at it with fresh eyes and also new research questions. So one of the things that's really interesting about this new approach is we're really looking at this holistically, like you said, in relationship and on a landscape scale and how all these things are related. And we are working really closely and collaboratively with our tribal partners, with historians, with military historians, with all different people to get as many perspectives and as much information. We've done a lot of data sharing, which has been fantastic. So we wouldn't be as far along as we are if we weren't working collaboratively. So I think that adds a lot to this new approach and kind of our open source approach to it. We're sharing everything as in real time, basically, with people. But I think that, yeah, it's looking at these things in perspective and in context really helps to give a better spin on the story. So rather than the poor Harris Cabin massacre, these two women, it's this horrible thing, which, again, I'm not to downplay what happened to them, but to look at it is in the context of, you know, you can't look at the Harris Cabin without thinking about the Lupton Massacre and, you know, without this whole process of war and the consequences leading up to it or you know, what led up to it and the consequences of each event and how it led to the next one.
And I did find myself wondering about the cultural sensitivities that you undertake when you're going into a site. I mean, is it any different based on who controlled the land at the time of the incident? In this case, it was a white homestead, not a Native site.
We really try to be sensitive about that, you know, and mindful both on this site and then also when we are at the Geisel Monument, which is a cemetery now, that we are working where people died And so it's something that's definitely on our minds, and we try to be respectful about that. And also, we, again, work really closely with our tribal partners. Robert Kenta of the Siletz tribe was down there with us for most of this project. But again, it's the goal is to get at the real story and to kind of to find the information. Archaeology, the data that we find doesn't lie. It's, you know, it is a way to kind of tell these stories in a way that respects the people that were there and kind of the context of what happened.
Well, and the stories do change over time. I mean, what we know about what happened in October of 1855 has come through a different lens, one that is a bit clearer than, mm-hmm. than the contemporary accounts in some ways.
Yeah.
As you say, the facts don't lie. I mean, this is you know, with the heroic story of the woman and her daughter, injured daughter, who held off the natives all night long with, you know, molding their bullets. Some of that's true and some isn't.
And that really, one of the things that really has been interesting to us about this story and also the Geisel story we've talked about before on this is how this rhetoric is really tied up in what Mark recognized coming from the East Coast is this captivity narrative, that these women are not really told in a way that tells their own personal story, but they're representative of, they become like symbols of civilization and purity and wholesomeness in this savage wilderness. So people are kind of trying to rationalize and process this colonial process through these archetypes rather than them just being women that were caught up in trying to survive. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to get through some of that rhetoric and look at, you know, like one of the things that we always kind of debate about is whether or not she actually knew how to load and shoot a gun. For me, it's really hard to believe that this homesteading woman in this area where she knew it was a dangerous place, not only because it was contested land, but there's bear and mountain lion sure. and stuff. So it's really hard for me to believe that she was like, how do I use this gun? You know,
but her innocence in that is part of the narrative because mm-hmm. she, even though she knew how to load a gun, it was more palatable to see her as this kind of innocent person whose martyrdom was kind of the sacrifice that needed to be made to secure people's place in the wilderness, whether or not that story was true or not.
Did both Mary and Sophia survive that night?
Yes.
Okay. So I don't understand, Mary Ann Harris, later Mary Chambers, got a check from the federal government?
She applied. Yeah, she got reparations for the loss of her. Mark, do you know what how that all
yeah,
worked out?
Yeah, I think we don't have that part down mm-hmm. quite clearly. We know they tried to, but whether she got it, we're not sure yet.
Okay. Chelsea Rose and Mark Tveskov at the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology. Another fascinating tale from underground history. Thanks so much for joining us in The Exchange.
Always great
Thanks
to be
bunch.
Here.